Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for October the 16th, 2017. This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David. How are you tonight?
Great.
And we have a good show ahead of us. I know we're waiting for our special guest, John Wells, to connect with us. John is the executive director of a nonprofit organization called the Military Veterans Advocacy Group. They have a national agenda and national impact in helping to improve VA benefits for veterans and their families. So I know we're waiting for John. So how you doing tonight, David?
Doing great. Had another busy week. We're doing a lot of promoting for the Burn Pit documentary that we discussed partly last week with our guest Lauren Price. And that show premiered, that film premiered last Monday in Los Angeles, and it's set to be screened at a number of theaters around the country, including Tampa, Florida, this Thursday, Brandon, Florida, on November the 1st, as well as other theaters around the country. Should be an eye-opening, an educational documentary about the issue of pollution caused by the open air burn pits used by the military. As we wait for our special guest tonight, let me go ahead and just give you an introduction about our guest, John Wells, and then we can talk about some other big issues. Our guest, hopefully shortly with us, will be John Wells, executive director of a nonprofit organization called Military Veterans Advocacy. John was on our show in late May. He's a very busy lawyer and one of the premier veteran advocates in the country. He's a retired Navy commander with extensive career experience as a surface warfare officer. He served on active duty in the Navy from 1972 until 1994, and over the course of his career, he was assigned to six different ships and several shore commands. He was qualified in all aspects of surface warfare, including command at sea. Of relevance to his second career, he attended law school at night while on active duty. He was a member of the Law Review staff and contributed to several law school publications. Upon retirement from the military, he settled in Louisiana and opened a general law practice which emphasized military and veterans law. He's represented military members and veterans throughout the country. He has extensive experience in both state and federal courts. He travels to Washington, D.C. often to meet with members of Congress as well as members of the VA. Earlier this year, he had met with the then new VA Secretary, Dr. David Shulkin. So we're hoping that John will be able to join us this evening. We want him to talk about a number of current issues that his organization is particularly involved in, including the benefits for the so-called Blue Water Navy veterans from the Vietnam War. As you recall, Agent Orange exposure is something that has caused many Vietnam veterans to suffer disease and illnesses over the decades, and the question is that is still being fought over is the extent to which sailors that were on Navy ships that were not close to shore, not in the so-called brown water, but out further from shore, the blue water veterans, to what extent they were affected and should be covered. Also of note, which we'll talk about, is the VA claims appeal legislation, which we've talked about a lot earlier this year. It's now become law, so if John can join us, I know he'll share his insights. But Richard and I, we have a lot to talk about on that as well. We can talk more about the issue of toxic exposure, whether it's Camp Lejeune, the open burn pits, and other installations. So, anyway,
you know, David, that the Burn Pits documentary, when Lauren Price was on the show when we were talking about it, I had asked, and I think it was even Amy Odom, I'd asked if the Burn Pits situation is today's veterans, you know, the young veterans, Agent Orange issue, and she said, yes, it is, absolutely. And, you know, it took so long for Agent Orange to finally get recognized for the contaminant that it was and the destruction and death that it caused so many veterans before it finally became compensable with the VA. You can only hope, you know, and you and I both know that we've got vets coming in and young vets, Iraqi vets, Afghanistan vets who describe the burn pits that they experience, and they all have certain skin issues and other issues that obviously can be related back to them. And hopefully it just won't take so as long as it took in the Agent Orange to get these veterans compensated for that exposure to the burn pit.
Right. Well, we'll have to see. But this this documentary that was made by film director and producer Greg Lovett, he was motivated by a book called The Burn Pits, subtitled The Poisoning of American Soldiers. It was written by Joseph Hickman, who has written other exposés about the military. And Joseph Hickman's book documented the pollution caused in Iraq and Afghanistan by these open-air burn pits. He did a lot of research. And film director Greg Lovett happened to read the book and thought, well, this is something that needs more publicity. So in 2016, he decided to make the film, and a couple months ago, he finished it. And what's interesting about it is that you know, a lot of veterans, they're already aware of this issue. There are quite a few veteran groups already out there. You can find their Facebook pages and websites. But this film is a documentary which hopefully will promote the discussion about this issue, because you know, that's similar to how the Agent Orange issue finally got the attention that it needed from the VA. And this film, the film is called Delay, Deny, Hope You Die, How America Poisoned Its Soldiers. And as I said earlier, it premiered in Los Angeles a week ago tonight. There's a screening this Thursday in Tampa, and November 1st in Brandon, Florida. But it's also being scheduled, or I should say tentatively scheduled, for other cities around the country, including New York City, Washington, D.C., Colorado Springs, Columbus, Ohio, Watertown, New York. And it's already shown this past week in Phoenix and Tucson. Plans are underway for showing in more cities. If our listeners are interested, you can go to the Facebook page for the Burn Pits documentary. Go to Facebook, type in the words Burn Pits documentary in the Facebook search engine, and it'll pull up the web page for that. And you can find the locations by clicking on the profile picture there where it says click here for tickets, and then that'll open up another window, and you can scroll down through the various cities where tickets are available. Or you can also go to the website tug.com, which is T-U-G-G.com, tug.com. And it's interesting because the screenings of this film are based on crowdfunding. So they really depend on a certain minimum number of tickets being sold. Those minimum numbers have been met in a number of cities already. I have a limited number of free tickets to the Brandon, Florida showing set for November 1st. So if you'd like a free ticket at the Brandon, Florida showing, contact me, grab your pen and paper. Here's the number, area code 813-662-0760 for free tickets for the Brandon, Florida showing. There are also dozens of free tickets still available for the Tampa, Florida showing, which is this Thursday, October the 19th. So give me a call, and I'll put you in contact with Lauren Price, who is the main promoter for the film there in Tampa. Again, my number is 813-662-0760. And another, as I say, if you're interested in this topic, there are other organizations trying to bring attention to this issue, and suggest you also read the book by Joseph Hickman called The Burn Pits, Poisoning of America's Soldiers. There was a... go ahead, Richard.
Speaking of phone numbers, before John hopefully gets on the show, I do want to remind our listeners that this is a call-in show, and we are the Veterans News Hour, so this is a veteran show, and we'd like to hear from our veterans and their families your views and comments and questions. So please, at any time during the next hour or 45 minutes, you can call in here at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. You know, we'd like to hear from our veterans. You know, tell us about what's going on in your life as a veteran, and if you have issues with the VA, and you know, good stuff, bad stuff. Tell us about your military service. But we'd like, you know, to get a lot of viewpoints, and we'd like to hear people share, because there's so much information out there. You know, David and I are approaching 5 years as a law firm come November 1. You believe that, huh, David? November 1st will be 5 years.
Yeah, it's been a busy
like
5 years
that we started, yeah. And we've seen a lot, and myself being a civilian coming into this, and David, as everyone knows, is a veteran. It's been an eye-opener for me over the last 5 years, and I enjoy the contact that I have with veterans and listening to their stories. So if you're out there and you have some time, give us a call at 1-888-627-6008. Again, 1-888-627-6008. I know, David, we have another show coming up, which I'm really looking forward to, on October the 30th. Everyone, hopefully, mark your calendars, and we're going to continue to publicize this on our Facebook page. Our special guest is going to be Rick Burns, who is the brother of Ken Burns. Rick will talk about his soon-to-be-released documentary entitled VA, The Human Costs of War. The film is due to be shown in early November on PBS, so it should be an eye-opener. It's going to be about the VA and everything that's been going on over there. Really looking forward to that one.
Yep, and we hope further guests in the future that will address the cost of war. You know, a few weeks ago, we had Dr. Catherine Lutton and Dr. Nita from Brown University, and they spoke about the cost of war. And it's a topic that I think there's not enough public discussion about, and it's a topic that hopefully we'll expand more on. But speaking of costs of war and costs of our military society, one issue that I'd like to talk about, Richard, at least for a few minutes, is the issue of, we've talked about it before, but I think it's worth examining further, which is the Camp Lejeune. One of the topics we're hoping John Wells to talk about tonight was the issue of toxic exposure, toxic pollution. And when members sign up to join the military, you know, they're basically at the orders of the government to go where the government says to go, to serve where they're told to go, and that could be to any part of the country, any part of the world, literally, with very little notice. And sometimes those conditions, certainly in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, but certainly other areas of the world, pretty austere conditions that don't have some of the environmental protections that we take for granted now in the United States, and Iraq and Afghanistan are two of those countries that, aside from the burn pit issue, which is really a self-inflicted wound by the military. Yeah, war is tough enough, but should we really be adding to the risks when the risks are controllable, at least at some point? But in addition to that, it's an issue we talked about before, which is stateside toxic exposure, and the Camp Lejeune, North Carolina situation of contaminated drinking water has now become, you know, kind of the poster case, if you will, but there are certainly other bases around the country. So let's spend a few minutes talking about reminding our listeners about what the Camp Lejeune toxic water contamination issue really is about. After a number of years of attention to this issue, the VA earlier this year finally enacted some changes to its regulations that say that for those that served, whether active duty, National Guard, reserves, that served at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, between August 1st of 1953 and December 31st, 1987, that if they served there for at least 30 days, and the days don't even have to be consecutive. In other words, the person might have served for 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks on another occasion, but it has to add up to at least 30 days. And if they then develop one of eight different conditions or diseases, that the VA will presume, it's a rebuttable presumption, which means the VA holds unto itself the decision of whether to rebut that presumption based on perhaps medical information. But the presumption is that they will service connect those diseases. Now, what are those eight diseases? That's really important. So let me mention what those eight diseases are. So veterans served at Camp Lejeune at least 30 days between August 1st of 1953, December 31st, 1987. They contract kidney cancer, liver cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, adult leukemia, multiple myeloma, Parkinson's disease, aplastic anemia and other myelodysplastic syndromes, or bladder cancer, any of those eight, that there's a rebuttal presumption that those are connected, that were due to the drinking contaminated drinking water at Camp Lejeune. We've already, Richard and I, we've already represented a number of veterans that have been covered by that, and we still have some cases on appeal for diseases that fall under a much longer list of 15 diseases, which were based on a statute passed by Congress a few years before that, which covered just VA health care. So it's an important issue, and it's not limited to, although these regulations are limited to Camp Lejeune, the issue of toxic exposure is not confined just to that. There are many other bases where there's contamination of the soil and the water. So I want to give people an overview. If any callers, any interested listeners want to call in and share their perspectives. Richard, what are your thoughts on that issue? Anything you'd like to share?
Well, you know, the I've been thinking about some of our clients who were serving at Camp Lejeune. You know, something that's different about the Camp Lejeune issue compared to some of the other cases that we handle is that the regional office in Louisville specifically handles these cases for the veterans, trying to get all the cases under one roof. Hopefully that's to expedite the cases a little bit faster than the normal route through the VA process.
And probably to try to inject some consistency, I would think.
Yeah, that too, and I'm waiting to see how quickly it really is going to be, because we have a few cases pending up there, and they seem to have stalled, but hopefully they'll pick up. But it's a great relief for a lot of our Marines who were stationed there, who have suffered over the years And not only have they suffered, but the their offspring. You know, we have stories in, of veterans that were stationed there, and they had children born there. And some of the children have some of the same disabilities that the father who was stationed there has. And that's still developing at this point, but who knows how that will go. I know we've got a couple of clients whose children are in their early 20s, and they're exhibiting similar disabilities that the, I shouldn't call them disabilities yet, but medical conditions that the father had.
If I could add something on that point, as far as family members, Congress had passed a law several years ago that addressed the issue of VA medical care, as opposed to what I was just speaking about a few minutes ago, which was disability compensation. And based on the law passed by Congress, veterans and their family members could get health care benefits specifically to cover out-of-pocket health care costs that were related to any of 15 conditions. So the list for health care coverage, which includes veterans and family members, is longer. It has 15 conditions rather than the shorter list of eight for disability compensation. But the 15 for health care for veterans and their family members include bladder cancer, breast cancer, esophageal cancer, female infertility, hepatic fatty-osis, kidney cancer, leukemia, lung cancer, miscarriage, multiple myeloma, myelodysplastic syndromes, neurobehavioral effects, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, renal toxicity, and scleroderma. As you can see, the list, it overlaps with the eight for disability compensation, but it adds a few. What I recall going back about a decade ago was when the Camp Lejeune issue was finally receiving more and more coverage in the national media. One of the conditions, one of the diseases that was being highlighted at that time was male breast cancer, which is on the list for health care still, and it's not limited to male breast cancer, which is rarer than female breast cancer, but that condition, that disease, strangely enough, did not make it onto the shorter list of eight diseases which are covered to the disability compensation. So that's an issue that will receive continued attention. In the Camp Lejeune situation, people may wonder, well, how can it be that this condition, this situation of contaminated drinking water continued well into the 1980s, because our listeners know that certainly by the 1970s, federal environmental regulations were getting pretty strict, and there were testing requirements, but believe it or not, unfortunately, there were on-base water wells that continued to be contaminated and were not shut down. Some were finally shut down in as late as 1985, and they had a number of chemicals in them, trichloroethylene, perchloroethylene, benzene, vinyl chloride, and some other compounds. And they had been contaminated from some sources on base, but also from some off-base substances from a dry cleaning company it got into the soil, into the groundwater, and contaminated the drinking water because of the wells that they were using on Camp Lejeune. But there are other installations around the country that experience similar things. Not all military bases get their drinking water from wells. Some get them from, depending on where they're located, from the local government water supply, just like any other citizen or resident or business would in a particular community. But those that rely on well water are more at risk for this sort of contamination, because military bases, certainly going back to when a lot of them were built in the 1940s for World War II, environmental concerns really were not at the were not on anyone's list, let alone being at the top of the list. So there was, you know, underground storage tanks which eventually leaked fuel into the groundwater. They used open burn pits. The same issue that we have found in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they were more common even in the United States. So the soil would get contaminated from the residue of the burning in addition to the air. But so these are important issues. One of our guests a couple months ago was Gavin Smith from an organization called CivilianExposure.org, and hopefully we'll have him on the show again sometime in the future to bring us up to speed on some of those issues. But it's an important topic. It's something that warrants more publicity and more discussion.
You know, on that Camp Lejeune, you were talking about the burn pit. You know, we've as a country, we've dealt with so many environmental issues, and we still deal with environmental issues. And I remember when I first started hearing about the burn pit issue, and I had a veteran in here, and he was a...
Richard, you may want to speak up a bit. I'm not sure that I can hear you too well.
And anyway, a veteran was in here who was exposed to the burn pits, and he was a contractor back here in the United States. His commanding officer was ordering everybody to put all this waste and other materials into this burn pit, into this pit, and they burned it. That's what we get the name of the burn pit. And he would say to this person, hey, you know, I really don't think we should be throwing all these paint cans and other things into this pit and setting it on fire. And the commander just said, look, you know, do it. I'm your superior. And so they did. So, you know, this is only 5-6 years ago. So even in this day and age, when we know about chemicals and the harm that they can cause people, we still drop the ball and we still expose people, in this case our military, to contamination, environmental contaminants.
Well, I think...
So it really doesn't surprise me that, you know, when you were saying before about late into the 80s that we had this issue at Camp Lejeune, because we're still doing it. And it's a problem. It's a problem.
Right. Well, I think a function of it is the fact that when you're going to war, being concerned about the environment is whether it's understandable to civilians or not, the reality is being concerned about the environment is not really high on anyone's concern when you're going to war, and it's a life or death situation, and war involves, quite frankly, you know, killing the enemy and destroying the enemy's property and whatever is there. And certainly the concerns about minimizing harm and proportionality and all those sorts of things are certainly part of the law of armed conflict and rules of engagement. But the reality is that when our forces go to war, their primary concern is to win the war as quickly as possible and to avoid getting killed themselves. So the environmental concerns just, quite frankly, are not as important. And I think most people get that.
Except when they kill our own guys. They're killing our own guys now.
Well, I know. That's the side effect, though, because
that's
they don't
the irony
realize
of it. You know,
they don't.
We're over there to do what we're supposed to do, but then we're killing our own guys. We're bringing them home, and they're all dying because of this.
Well,
stuff,
the thing though is it's not an obvious thing. That's the reality. It's not obvious. It should be obvious, but it's not as direct as other risks. And you're also dealing with the environment and the military, which is you got to get the mission accomplished, and the mission comes first. And there's all sorts of risks at war of getting killed, and this just happens to be another one of them. But I think the situation with the open burn pits was that once the forces, you know, had defeated, overthrown the Iraqis, overthrown the Afghanistan, the Taliban government, and they were in control of the country, and they were essentially settling in. That's not to say there weren't constant battles and IEDs, et cetera, But the, once they establish, particularly these large installations like Balad in Iraq and some of these other ones where there are literally tens of thousands of troops and essentially what would appear to be like a permanent installation, tens of thousands of troops, thousands of contracting workers. I mean, they were basically small towns unto themselves, and they were there potentially permanent establishments. They had their own flight lines. They had all sorts of logistical and supply. They had everything they needed, a hospital. They had all sorts of things, except it took them a number of years to decide they better start thinking about the environmental pollution and having some incinerators. It's not a matter of should they burn this garbage. Their alternative would be to bury it or to ship it somewhere else, not feasible. But if they used enclosed incinerators, that would be more effective in minimizing the pollution out into the air. I say minimize. I don't mean totally eliminate. The sort of things that that they do in the United States, if they're not burying the stuff, that it'd be a way to minimize, not totally eliminate the environmental risks. And part of the criticism here is that it took the government way too long to do that, and meanwhile, thousands of service members were exposed to this contamination. And then, as you said, Richard, it's killing some of them, and it's making many others, thousands, very sick. But that's the purpose of this documentary, which is coming out. It's already been shown in some cities, and it will be in a number of other cities throughout October and November.
And like you said, David, you know, this film will be just another way of getting the information out to the general public who, up until now, they've never even heard of the burn pits syndrome and the conditions
right.
that it's causing our veterans. So I'm going to switch gears here, David. Over the years, we have given tips to our listeners. And I wanted to remind our listeners that if you're looking for an opportunity to work in a job helping and serving our nation's veterans, the VA currently has approximately 45,300 vacancies around the country. Go to www.va.gov/jobs for more information. Also, many VA offices around the country periodically hold jobs fairs that you can attend to help with the process. Please check out the VA's website. Again, the website is www.va.gov/jobs, and maybe there's a job out there for you. I know the VA could use some good people there working because they need the help. Lord knows they need the help. I also, this came up today when I was talking to a client. I want to alert veterans who have pending disability claims that they may be scheduled for their compensation and pension exams, often called a CNP exam, with private doctors who are contracting with the VA. I'm finding this is happening more often than not, that these veterans aren't being given these exams at the VA and they're being done locally in their communities. And many of our clients already have had their CNP exams through a private contractor called Veterans Evaluation Services. And there are other contractors around the country. Veterans should be aware that the contracted CNP exams are being done at locations other than the VA medical facilities that the veterans are used to visiting for medical care. We recommend that veterans ask examiners if they are reviewing the veteran's claims file, or more commonly known as the C file, before making their report. We also recommend that veterans request a copy of the CNP report so that they have a chance to rebut any errors before the regional office makes a decision. This is very important, David, because what I'm finding is that the examiners who are then issuing these CNP exams aren't really doing that great job, and it seems like all they're doing is pushing volume out the door rather than quality of examination. From what I understand, they're being paid by the volume of veterans that they're seeing. So they're rushing them in and out. And I was talking to one of my veterans today And when he got to the office there in Orlando, got there about 9:30, and it was a very small office. I think he said there was like one or two examiners, not even a doctor. It was a practicing nurse practitioner. And there were 37 people ahead of him, and he got there at 9:30. I asked him to call me when he finally left, and he left around 1:30, and he said there were about 20-some-odd people behind him. So I really question the kind of examinations that are coming out of these doctor's offices, nurse's offices. So I'm telling my veterans, you know, be on your toes. Go into these examinations, you know, with both barrels ready, armed, ready to go, because they're not there to help you. They're there to push the VA agenda, which is not to pay you your compensation. So, you know, take notes. And if you don't like the way things go, then when you're done with the examination, write down what happened. Call your representative or your attorney and let them know, because you can, you know, submit a statement as to what happened at that examination and just get it on the record that, you know, you didn't like the way things went. And I mean, I had one client that went in there. He had a varicose vein issue, and the examiner that he saw was an allergist specialist. So what one had to do with the other is anyone's guess. So there's another tip for our veterans out there. How about you, David? What do you think?
Well, I think that's a great issue to highlight, because these compensation and pension, or C&P exams, are so important, both in many cases to service-connect the disability, but as well as to rate the severity of it. So if these examinations are being rushed through, you know, in only 10 or 15 minutes, some of these disability questionnaires, which these doctors have to fill out, some are 9 or 10 pages long just for one particular disability, and others, like the psychological ones for post-traumatic stress, you know, they require extensive testing and time to talk with the veteran and evaluate. And when they're just spending 20 or 30 minutes, it's not doing the veteran justice. So these reports come out that are really not accurate. And what does it do? It gives the regional office an excuse to deny the claim or issue a low rating. And that pushes the veteran into the appeal system, which I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about. In August, this legislation was finally passed by Congress and signed by President Trump. It's called the Veterans Appeal Improvement and Modernization Act of 2017. It has a nice name to it, right? They're going to improve it, and they're going to modernize this act. But really, what is it going to do? Most veterans know now that the way the system works is they file a claim, it goes to their regional office, and a decision might be made 3, 6, 9, 12 months. It's hard to say. It depends on the number of issues and the complexity of that claim. But at some point, the regional office will make a decision. It may be after they've sent the veteran to a compensation and pension exam, like we were just talking about. But a decision is made. If the decision is unfavorable in some respect, then the veteran can start appealing it. And the appeal process actually has several steps to it, but the first step is typically, at least what the VA tells you in their standard letter, is that if you're unhappy with the decision, if you disagree, file what's called a notice of disagreement. And a few years ago, the VA came out with a specific form that you have to use. It's a two-page form, a notice of disagreement. Before they came out with that form, then any letter you would write would should be considered as a disagreement. But there was all sorts of litigation over whether the disagreement was clear enough. So the VA finally came up with a standard form. And that notice of disagreement form, the NOD, is very important. It has to be filed within 1 year of the date of the decision. And at that point, you can ask for what they call the traditional review process, where just someone at a regional office will review it, or a higher-level review by someone called a decision review officer, who is supposed to give it a closer review, supposed to have more experience and conduct what they call a de novo review. De novo meaning that they're looking at the case with a fresh set of eyes without any bias based on what's already happened. But, Richard, you and I know that when a veteran files a notice of disagreement, it can be 2 or 3 or 4 years before a decision review officer takes a look at the case or grants a hearing if you've requested a hearing, which we often do because we want to make sure we've had an opportunity to sit down face-to-face with the VA decision-maker. But anyway, the point is it takes a long time, 2, 3, 4 years for that next step. And if the decision review officer, or if you don't use the decision review officer, just what they call a traditional review, which is just by another VA employee, not necessarily one that's any more experienced than the first one, literally takes years. But then after that, then you can appeal to the Board of Veterans Appeals. Again, where you have another wait, 3, 4, 5 years before you might get a hearing with the Board of Veterans Appeals. And what we found, Richard, you know, in many of our cases, a victory, an initial victory at the Board of Veterans Appeals level, in some cases, the most you can get is a remand. That's not the most legally you can get because the BVA could grant the claim outright, but in many cases, what the BVA finds is that the claim wasn't thoroughly developed. There wasn't a sufficient record for the regional office to make a decision, so the BVA will remand or send the case back, which from the time of the BVA, the Board of Veterans Appeals decision, for that remand to be completed after could be another year or 2 years. We had a case recently with one of our clients. The Board of Veterans Appeals made a decision which was favorable. They completely agreed with our arguments and completely overturned everything that the regional office had done and sent it back for a do-over. Well, with further exams, medical opinions, it took the regional office literally 2 years to fulfill the orders, do what the BVA said. 2 years, and we still were in disagreement with what the regional office did, so we had to appeal it back to the BVA, and that took another couple of years. And just a few months ago, the BVA did another remand, saying the regional office still has not gotten it right. So it's going to be just another. So it's not surprising why veterans often give up out of complete frustration with the ridiculous system. But anyway, going back to what I said earlier, and Richard, I'd like to get your thoughts about it, is the VA for years has been talking about, let's revamp it. So they really pushed, they got some of the major veteran groups, but not all of them, on board to push this Veterans Appeal Improvement and Modernization Act, and it's going to totally revamp the procedures for what happens after an initial decision is made and the options for veterans. Now, before I explain what those choices will be, Richard, let me get your thoughts so far, because we've talked about this before. What are your insights about this?
You know, coming from the civilian world and having dealt a lot with insurance companies, the more I saw the VA, the more I realized it's nothing more than a government-sponsored insurance company. And like every insurance company, their goals are to bring in premiums. Now, veterans don't pay premiums, but their goal is not to pay out. You know, you see it all the time with people involved with hurricanes, and you know they FEMA and all these other things where the people don't get compensated. Well, the VA is no different, and clearly, whether you know each individual employee is consciously thinking this or he's just trained this way, but you know they routinely pass out lowball ratings, hoping that the veteran will accept the lowball rating. And then if the veteran doesn't, if he's got a good team behind him and says he got to appeal, well, then as you were talking about earlier, David, you know, you end up appealing that, and you can end up appealing it again. I did an appeal for a woman, PTSD as a result of military sexual trauma. She initially got 10%, and she hired us. We got her now to 70%. But clearly, not only with the PTSD, but with other combined disabilities, she should be 100%. Well, you know, I filed another notice of disagreement today. And you, David, you know how long that's going to take now for that claim to be processed. Fortunately, right. She's a young woman, and she has time to spend and litigate it. But, you know, we have that veteran, David, who's 89 years old, and he's been fighting for 70 years, since 1947, off and on. And finally, we were able to get him service-connected for gastrointestinal disease, going back to, he was diagnosed on August 26, 1947. And the BVA was great. They gave us a decision within 35 days because it was on the advanced docket. It was remanded back to the VA, and without even doing an examination on our client, within days they issued a rating, and they gave him 10%, which was virtually nothing. And when you look at his condition and you look at the diagnosis that are in the manual, clearly he was entitled to probably around 60-70%. So he's 89 years old, and now what does he have to do? He has to appeal the 10% rating, and hopefully our client will live. And but it's just a shame, because we're, you know, it's just constantly, you know, chasing the compensation for these veterans, and the VA has a very specific way of dealing with it, and that is delay, delay, now die. And quite frankly, it ticks me off.
Right.
So all these new things that they're trying to do out there, all this new legislation, personally, I don't see it correcting the problem. Because as long as the VA has that first thing at the forefront, which is to minimize the ratings for these veterans, lowball them, it's not going to change. And, you know, the appeal process is just going to continue on, and unfortunately our veterans are going to be stuck in it.
Right. Right. And let me spend just a couple minutes and summarize what this new legislation, this Veterans Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act of 2017, is going to do. And keep in mind, just because it was signed in August doesn't mean it's magically going to result in immediate changes. It's not working that way. The VA has, under legislation, 18 months to start implementing these changes. Maybe they'll start doing that on a trial basis sooner, but we'll have to see. But what will happen is this. New legislation, a veteran files a claim. Let's say that the claim is denied or is issued a rating that the veteran believes is unfairly low. The veteran will then have three options, three choices, if they're unhappy with the initial decision. First, they can seek a higher-level review by a regional office on the same evidence. Or number two, they can file a supplemental claim with a regional office that would include submitting additional evidence. And number three, they can appeal directly to the Board of Veterans Appeals. In other words, they skip the current step of a decision review officer. They can appeal directly to the Board of Veterans Appeals, resulting in either a possible hearing if they request it, or they can waive the hearing, or they can present written evidence or waive that. But let me talk about each of these three just briefly here. The first option would be a higher-level review at the regional office on the same evidence. Interesting thing about that is the veteran at that point can't submit any new evidence. In other words, whoever reviews it at that regional office level is going to be reviewing the same evidence as it existed that already led to the unhappy decision. So I think, given the VA's past culture, that's likely just, in most cases, going to result in the same bad decision being rubber-stamped. Why? Because the legislation specifically removes the VA's current legal duty to assist veterans after an initial decision. And that duty to assist is pretty broad in terms of helping veterans by identifying what's needed, by helping them get evidence that is out there that perhaps the veteran needs help obtaining, whether medical records or a medical opinion, a medical exam, those kinds of things. The second option, they can file a supplemental claim, which basically means that now, okay, they can submit additional evidence. To me, that's more spinning around on the hamster wheel. A lot of veterans now call the current system. It's like being on a hamster wheel, you know, where you're just spinning around. A lot of motion, a lot of energy being spent, but you're really not getting anywhere. You're just going in a circle. Well, I think that's likely going to happen. Now, some proponents of the legislation say, well, the VA is supposed to be much clearer under the new rules to identify what's needed, and therefore there should be less guessing on the part of the veterans. Well, we'll see. They haven't done a very good job on that historically. The third option, they can appeal directly to the Board of Veterans' Appeals. They can skip the current decision review officer step, and the BVA will supposedly have two separate tracks for appeals, those where the veteran doesn't want a hearing, doesn't want to submit new evidence. That's supposedly the faster track. The other track is where they want a hearing and or submit new evidence. The problem with this legislation, though, is it really does nothing to fix the current backlog of between 400,000 and 500,000 claims that are currently on appeal. We're really not clear what the VA is going to do, how they're going to bring those cases into the new system, and if they do, rather than keeping them under the current system, the question is going to be, is that going to result in speeding things up any? A lot of unknowns. Basically, as some of the big major veteran groups even acknowledge themselves, they're putting faith in the VA, and I'm not sure that faith in the VA bureaucracy is well placed, given decades of experience. So, veterans, the listeners out there, be on the lookout. There will be changes on the horizon on the appeals system. Time will tell whether it's improved things, but my personal belief is, ironically, it's going to make the system even more adversarial because, as our guest on our show 2 weeks ago, Amy Odom from the National Veterans Legal Services Program said, you know, a lot of this depends on having good representation, a good advocate who knows what he or she is doing and thoroughly prepared a case for there to be a good outcome. And realistically, that's not always the case. And certainly many veterans, they feel like they ought to be able to do it themselves. It's not supposed to be adversarial with their own government. But we'll see. But in any event, we're rapidly running out of time tonight, Richard. So perhaps if you could share with us the Coaching Into Care program.
Yeah, I was just about to. That's, you know, every week we remind our listeners about the Coaching Into Care program. If you are a family member of a veteran who has left the service and is having a tough time transitioning to civilian life, please be aware of the VA's program called Coaching Into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call at toll-free 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., again, VA's Coaching Into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they didn't get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Richard. It's been a quick hour. I would like to thank everyone for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on VBS Radio Station 1. We'd like to thank our show sponsors, including American Legion Post 303 of Bonita Springs, Florida, Mr. Charles M. Newman of Florida, and Corey and Hurley Law Group, which represents veterans and disability cases around the country. We'd like to thank our producer at VBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom, and we hope our listeners will tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, have a great week. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, You can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.